This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovec. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
So let's get to it, everybody, and let's talk about what President Biden had to say. And this has certainly caught everyone's attention. President Biden last night on CBS's 60 Minutes saying U.S. military forces would defend Taiwan from an unprecedented attack, his latest pledge of support as his administration seeks to deter China from increasing military pressure on the democratically elected government in Taipei. Here's more of what President Biden had to say.
There's a one China policy, and Taiwan makes their own judgments about their independence. We are not moving. We're not encouraging their being independent. We're not. That's their decision.
But would U.S. forces defend the island?
Yes, if in fact there was an unprecedented attack.
That was President Biden, courtesy of 60 Minutes. Let's get to it right now with Bloomberg News White House correspondent Josh Wingrove joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Josh, good to have you with us. So President Biden makes these comments in an interview on 60 Minutes. And then what does the White House do in reaction?
Does he think, Josh, nobody was listening?
Yeah. I mean, it's the aftermath that I'm interested in, too, right? The damage control that they do.
Yeah. The White House messaging on Taiwan is strategic ambiguity, and the president, flips back and forth depending on the day between the strategic part and the ambiguous part, I think, a little bit here and there. Now, he's made comments like this before, most recently in May, when he made this sort of same signal at the time. Of course, Beijing reacted pretty strongly to that. The White House tried to put the toothpaste back in the tube, saying, look, the one China policy has not changed. This is all consistent with that. But I suppose one or two things is happening.
Okay.
One is that the president likes a little bit of uncertainty in the mix, and he keeps injecting it and kind of to keep the Chinese government on their toes a bit about what the U.S. response would be. The other, maybe a little less generous, maybe, is that perhaps this is just how he feels, and he just can't help but kind of spurt it out, whether it fits neatly into the U.S. policy or not. But what they're saying today, that the cleanup, if you will, or the follow-up maybe, is just simply that he has said this before. We said before that there's no change to the one China policy. That remains the case. They're trying to sort of head off any Chinese reaction.
Well, that's it, Josh. Can you, as the president of the United States, say, yeah, I stand by the one China policy, but if there's an unprecedented attack, we can't stand by it. We have to defend democracy.
Depends on what unprecedented attack means, of course. And, this comment, of course, does come bookending something pretty important that happened between the last time he said it and last night, which is, of course, Speaker Pelosi's visit. That really raised tensions in the region. The president went so far as to say that he thought the Department of Defense thought it was not a great idea for the speaker to go when she was not publicly confirming that she would. Of course, she ultimately did. That led to Chinese military exercises, missile launches, sort of saber-rattling in and around Taiwan. And so he's sort of, I guess, drawing a line in the sand again now with this comment saying, this is where he is. I should note, though, that in another part of the interview, he sort of gave a more of a calming sort of a view on China when he was asked about Putin and Xi Jinping's relationship, and said that as of now, there's no indication that China has provided weapons or support to Russia in its war in Ukraine. And, of course, he said that he'd warned Xi Jinping that there would be consequences in terms of a lack of foreign investment, and American investment in particular, if that happened. So, you know, this Taiwan comment is getting a lot of attention. It should, of course, arguably the newsiest thing of that interview. But the other sort of trappings of the interview were one that thinks that right now he's actually kind of optimistic that China isn't fully aligning as of yet with Moscow. And that, of course, is good news for the West and all the countries that are trying to prop up Ukraine in this fight.
Well, it kind of makes sense too, Josh, coming off of even President Xi, right, in that first face-to-face since, was it COVID, with President Putin, where he too kind of seemed to just maybe put Putin a little bit on guard. So I feel like there's some, perhaps some layering going on here. Can I ask you something, though? I always feel like...
always.
Like, I don't know that I can make a blanket statement, but he is President of the United States. He knows when he says something, it's going to be taken largely at face value. Is that true of this particular president, or do we sometimes say, he just kind of speaks top of mind?
Yeah, no malarkey, Carol.
No malarkey.
Yeah, no malarkey. That's right. I think Joe Biden's candor is probably pretty priced in at this point. This is not a guy that stuck to script all that much as vice president, and he's continued that as president. You know, he does not do a lot of interviews. That's what made the 60 Minutes one kind of must watch for those in my field of work. The last one he did was several months ago, a sit down with the Associated Press. He does kind of one-off things, like he did something with Jay Leno recently, that sort of thing. But he's done far fewer TV and print interviews than, for instance, Barack Obama did at this point in his presidency. So as to why that is, you know, who's to say? We live in a different environment. You know, maybe they think they can get their message out other ways, through other channels, more direct channels. Don't have to go through the mainstream press as much. Of course, Trump spoke to the press all the time. Right. But on the flip side, towards the end, didn't hold any press briefings. Biden team holds press briefings all the time. So it's sort of like pick your path a little bit. But he does these so rarely. That's why all eyes are on them. I kind of leave, maybe it's eye of the beholder on when he goes off script a little bit, whether that's part of the calculus and whether they do these or not. You know, anyone can do their own judgment.
What else, Josh, did 60 Minutes and Scott Pelley get out of the president last night, especially when it comes to Ukraine, but also second term ideas?
Is it going to run?
Yeah. There were a bunch of stories that came out of that on Ukraine. I mean, he said that they would do whatever it takes to defend Zelensky's government and defend the country against Russian attacks. That's consistent with what he said before. On 2024, he said they haven't really had an explicit conversation. Remember, Joe Biden, if he runs for re-election, will be the oldest president to do it. As of now, he says regularly he's intending on running for re-election, but he's said something to the effect of fate has intervened in his life many times, and he's sort of not ruling out the fact that things could go sideways. But last night sure sounded like a guy that thought, as of now, he'll be running.
Yeah.
The other thing that really caught on was the pandemic. He said, quote, the pandemic is over, walking around with Mr. Pelley at the Detroit Auto Show. Yeah. I was on that trip. And, he's right in the sense that, like, there was virtually no mask, that sort of thing.
Wow.
That's getting jumped. Because, of course, it's not. The COVID isn't over, but
I got to tell you, Josh, the president has to tell that to my mask, which was on my face on the subway this morning. Josh Wingrove, love you. White House correspondent, Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Washington, D.C. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's get to the story that is the Bloomberg Big Take today. It's also among our most read on the Bloomberg Terminal, and it will be in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week, due out later this week. It has to do with what, Tim, many would argue is our biggest story of the day, certainly for the Bloomberg audience, and it has to do with the global race to hike interest rates and how that is tilting economies toward recession.
Yeah, this is a piece by Rich Miller. It is Bloomberg, the Bloomberg Big Take as well. It's about the global race to hike rates, tilting economies toward recession. Carol, as you mentioned, it's not just the United States,
nope.
Joel Weber and Rich. It is the entire world dealing with this right now. Rich Miller is economics reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from our Washington, D.C. bureau. Joel Weber is the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So, Joel, we were talking a little bit earlier about President Biden on 60 Minutes last night. He was also asked about inflation. One thing that I thought of when I was listening to his answer is that this is not just something that's happening in the United States that the U.S. is dealing with. You got pretty much every central bank trying to get interest rates to a place where inflation comes down.
Yeah, and it's almost become, as Rich writes here, a competition. And let's see who can hike these rates faster. Rich, remember when money was cheap? That was fun. It's going to get more expensive and here in the U.S. and elsewhere, right? And among everything that's happening, I think it's, one thing that's really interesting here is, like, it does seem like with interest rates, central bankers are just becoming myopically focused on taming inflation at all costs. And that increasingly starts to look like recession, right? But it is a global one, not just a U.S. story. So even though, we're going to hear from Jay earlier this week, how is this manifesting itself elsewhere?
Yeah, well, as you say, I mean, it's incredible. When you look through it, it's like 90 central banks have, hiked, and, like more than half of them have hiked by three quarters, some of them more than that. And as you say, like, everybody's trying to out-hawk each other, right? out-compete each other. And there are some people worried, with everybody going in the same direction, the boat's going to tip over into global recession, right? So that's one thing. And the other thing is when you go... Milton Friedman, monetary policy affects the economy with long and variable lags. They raise rates, you first see it in the stock market weakens, then you sort of see it in, the housing market slows. And it comes at the very end, it comes into inflation. But as you say, if they're myopically, focusing on inflation, that means they're probably going to overdo it, and that's going to push us into a recession, maybe a recession, all around the globe.
Yeah, Rich, and we're talking millions of jobs here. As you write in your piece, analysts at BlackRock reckon that bringing inflation back to the Fed's 2% goal would mean a deep recession and 3 million more unemployed. And then also hitting the ECB's target would require an even bigger contraction. All that right now is spelling out a global recession, something that affects the entire globe. So what does this look like when it comes to economic growth?
Well, I mean, basically, no growth. The economies are contracting, right? So I would think, that translating that 3 million unemployed into, growth, you'd probably have 2.5% contraction in the economy, wow. In the U.S. economy. An actual contraction, as opposed to the phony contraction that we got early this year, when it was mainly because we were importing more. But this would be actual contraction, and the pain would be in the labor market. And one of the questions is the politicians now, with the most part, except for Senator Warren, they're sort of cheering the Fed on. Yeah, inflation's bad. Go ahead, Fed, raise the rates. But, once you start seeing some pain, as
right.
Jay Powell has promised us, you wonder whether the politicians will change their tune.
Rich, we're already seeing pain. We were just talking about the housing market with Patrick Clark, right? Those high mortgage rates. And it made me want to ask you about lag effect. What is it really? I mean, we're seeing it already on housing, but these successive and cumulative interest rate hikes by global central banks, right? All of a sudden, I feel like it's like when you've got a clog and you're pushing through, nothing's happening, right. And then all of a sudden it comes flying through. I'm waiting for that. Is that what's going to happen?
I mean, that is the danger. And that's in the past why the central banks would, when they did raise rates, they'd go in small steps, like 25 basis points. So you go slowly and you see, you have a little more time to see what impact your rates were having, but when you're going, when you're galloping ahead in like 75 basis point chunks, you don't have as much time to sort of gauge how the earlier hikes are affecting growth. And as you say, housing is kind of in the crosshairs here. But if housing weakens, and people are buying lesser appliances, if people feel that their house prices are going down, then they're going to save more, and that just has ripples. So it just takes time. But, as you say, it could sort of be like an exploding toilet, right? could splash right into our faces.
I didn't see that reference.
Wasn't that a cover of Bloomberg Business?
Yeah, Joel is known for some Gracie covers.
I know.
The barf bag was a favorite. Might need to dust that one off. Look for the your passenger next to you. You can get their bag too. Rich, one of the things that I thought was a little bit frightening that I hadn't totally appreciated was the growth forecast charts in your story. U.S. goes down pretty dramatically when you start to look out. Euro area worse. U.K., oof, man, that looks really bad in 2023. Just from a sense of, the folks that you talk to and the data that you're looking at, is it starting to feel like there's that pit in the stomach that's like, oh, God, this is going to get really bad?
Yeah, I mean... Truth be told, the U.S., we've held up surprisingly well. The labor market's held up pretty well. And it's, most of the concern right at the moment is faced on Europe and the U.K., where they're getting hit with, this incredible net gas price shock. And, at the same time, you have the central banks raising rates and, But the problem in the U.S. is we've got this, embedded inflation problem. And the stronger the economy is, it means probably the Fed's going to have to work that much harder to slow things down. And that's when, you get risks that they slow it down too much and we go slipping into a recession.
Rich, real quickly, just got about 30, 40 seconds here. Is inflation still a supply problem or is it now a kind of more demand problem? And that's where the Fed can do something, just quickly.
I think in the U.S. it's probably becoming more and more a demand problem, particularly in the labor market. With wages are going up about 5-6% a year, and to be consistent with the Fed's target, they have to be going up 3.5%. So, got a long way to go. That's why people think unemployment is going to have to go up a lot.
So workers finally get a break, and now it's like.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah,
it's not a good thing.
We won't blame you, Rich. Don't worry.
Wow. Or we can. Oh. It all started here because of Rich Miller's excellent reporting.
He's not in the room. He's in D.C., so there's nothing you can do about it.
Please send all comments directly to Rich Miller.
All right. This story, as we mentioned, it's going to be in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week due later this week. It's also already on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/Business Week. Our thanks to Bloomberg News Economics reporter Rich Miller and, of course, the editor of Business Week, Joel Weber. This is Bloomberg Radio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
It is the second busiest port in North America, generating some 2.6 million jobs across the U.S., some 175 shipping lines connecting Long Beach to 217 ports. And this past August, its second busiest August on record, following the busiest August on record set the previous year back in August of 2021. So we're going to get a great state of our shipping and cargo industry.
For that, we turn to Mario Cordero, Executive Director of the Port of Long Beach. He joins us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio. Mario, it's great to have you back with us. And in person, too. Welcome to New York.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the kind invitation.
So Carol just mentioned some of the data that we have, and we have a ton of it, thanks to you and the team. But second busiest, it may not be the best thing for a port to see the business come down year over year. But can we argue that it actually is a good thing because it's not as backed up as it was a year ago?
Well, certainly, when you look at the metrics here, Currently, we have in the San Pedro Bay complex 12 vessels backed up trying to get into the ports. So if you go back to January, that number was 109. So just on that alone, it's a tremendous progress being made.
Is any of that seasonal?
Pardon me?
Is any of that seasonal?
You know, we're in peak season right now, and I think we're at the peak, so to speak.
Okay.
Again, you're looking at the numbers of the consumer demand or some softening on that. So for the third and fourth quarter of the year, I think we're looking to diminish demand in terms on the consumer front.
Well, that's what we wanted to. I mean, I feel like you have such a great vantage point when it comes to what's going on in the economy. We're all kind of on pins and needles trying to figure out what comes next as we wait for certainly the Fed decision. What is your read on the state of the U.S. economy right now?
I think we have a strong economy. We certainly have a strong labor market. And keep in mind where we were 2 years ago. I think part of...
So 2 years was terrible, right? The outlier. So are we pre-pandemic levels or like how do you...
Well, in terms of the job market, I think we're approaching pre-pandemic levels in terms of the jobs that have been added since then. But I think the point is we've had a very fast recovery from a worse scenario that we experienced. So in that regard, the economy was real hot. And now, of course, what we're trying to do as a nation is kind of soften that. So I think, again, the $64,000 question is, you know, where is inflation going to go? So I think that's the outlier in terms of what's to come.
Well, when you look at the activity at the port, and it's really just fascinating about just the amount of flow through there and what, 62% of the imports and 21% of the exports moving through your port. Largest trading partner country is China, which accounts for so much of it. Does recession come to your mind a lot, which is certainly something we are worried about, especially as global central banks are increasingly doing everything and anything in terms of hiking rates to stem off global inflation. So do you think a lot about recession in terms of the activity you're seeing?
Well, Carol, a good friend of mine, an economist, Paul Bingham, who's been following this industry for many, many years, once said, tell me how many containers go through the Port of Long Beach and I'll tell you how good the economy is. So far, good. Is inflation a concern? Yes. However, again, if you look at the latest plan of action by the Federal Reserve, they believe they may be able to control this. We'll wait to see what that decision is in the coming week, whether that's 0.75 or a 1.0 increase. But I think it's safe to say that, we went through an unusual quick recovery. The consumer demand has really been extraordinary in the last year and a half. Energy prices have gone down. Admittedly, grocery prices have gone up. So I think what we're looking to is, again, a very good job market, good consumer demand, considerable in terms of what we experienced previously. But again, we are looking at some economic growth, certainly in the global arena. And as to the United States, I think we're going to feel some of that also.
So sounds like you're saying we're not in a recession right now.
Today, we're not. I mean, are we moving towards a recession for 2023? I mean, there's a debate. I know that all this has highlighted.
But Mary, help me out with like the shipping, understanding shipping. Mm-hmm. Having recently been at the Panama Canal, fascinating to just understand mm-hmm. it. Same thing with your port. Are companies booking for December? Are they booking for November? Like how much visibility or how much forward-looking visibility do you actually have to get an idea of, wow, things are going to slow down?
Well, what I can tell you is part of the problem that we experience here in the nation's largest, most strategic gateway is the advancing of that inventory. So looking forward, some of these companies were advancing the inventory, but they certainly didn't want to put us back to where we were in the second half of 2020. So I think it's interesting to watch. You know, there's some bigger companies that start looking at their labor force. But at this point, I will say that in terms of the coming holiday Christmas season, we're going to be very well established in terms of that inventory because much of that has been advanced.
Already. So, it's already where it needs to be.
Right. I mean, for the Port of Long Beach, if you look at the first 8 months of this year, we've superseded the numbers of our record year last year at this point by 4.6%. So that's kind of an indicator in terms of that continued volume. But again, it's going to be interesting to see how we end the third and approach the fourth quarter.
Because it does make me feel like people are pulling a lot of stuff forward because they just don't want to be caught off guard.
Like things could get more expensive, so they're buying it now.
Yeah, or empty shelves, and you don't want that on Christmas, right? Especially if you're a retailer.
Correct, and I firmly believe we're not going to see that scenario for sure.
Hey, tell us a little bit about what you're seeing based on where port traffic is coming from and what that says about economies around the world. I mean, we saw FedEx lose 20% of its market value on Friday after it pulled its earnings forecast because of weakness specifically in Europe and in Asia. I know you guys have a really good view on Asia. Is there any softness there?
Well, first of all, for FedEx, you saw that because a lot of the numbers for FedEx in terms of what the CEO indicated here this past week, that component in terms of what their loss were in earnings was in the Asia market. So I think on that respect, certainly what we see in Asia, more specifically China, you are seeing a slowdown there in China. So that is the domino effect.
But is that based on lockdowns in China? Is it based on the COVID zero policy, or is it all tied to that?
It's all tied to what precipitated these times, that is the COVID-19 pandemic. So I think, again, we'll see how China handles this. I mean, the good news is I don't think you're going to see the kind of lockdowns in China that we saw in the past, because they're also watching their numbers in terms of their economic growth. So there'll be a softening. And as we approach 2023, I believe that the good news, the supply chain, certainly in the United States, I think we're now seeing some semblance of normalization and moderation in the supply chain. So that's very good news.
So, okay. And that's the thing. I mean, that was obviously the problem, right, during the pandemic and stuff. You feel like that has calmed down completely or close to it?
It's calmed down substantially. So I think, again, at least for the West Coast, that cargo continues to move. I think the delays have diminished, and certainly the backups have substantially diminished. Now, there is one asterisk to this, and that's the state of the rail equipment, the ongoing issue with the Class 1 railroads, and for the West Coast, the imbalance of the eastbound, westbound equipment issue. So for the Port of Long Beach, we're a little bit better on the rail dwell, which is 11 days.
Yeah.
Nothing to brag about, because in normal times, that's about 3.5 days. But it's certainly better than the 13, 12 days we were seeing in recent months. So incremental progress.
Is that why is it still such a lag or such a problem? And not back to what it should be?
Yeah, I think a lot has to do with the congestion in the inland intermodal yards. I mean, this goes back to Chicago and the hubs there. I think the Class 1 railroads have been rather challenged. They have their own challenges with regard to shortage of labor and equipment issues. So I think, unfortunately, we've been the victims of the lack of that rail car, which, in my view, should not happen at the world's most strategic, significant gateway. I am disappointed on that point.
That it's happened. We're talking with Mario Cordero. He's executive director of the Port of Long Beach. As we said, it is the second busiest port in North America. And so a great way to get a feel of what's going on in the economy. Do you feel like, based on what happened and the supply chain problems and just it wasn't just port issues, but it was trucking, it was just kind of all along the line, that we will ultimately see in some ways more automation potentially come into this industry? Or does it need to?
Well, I mean, those are two very good questions. But let me first of all address the first one in terms of what we experience. I think the good news for those of us in this industry, people finally saw the importance and witnessed the importance of a supply chain. We all found out that the supply chain is not as resilient as some people may have thought.
We took it for granted.
So, you know, the essential workforce, which includes obviously our safety officers, our people in the health industry during this pandemic, but also our people who work in goods movement, people who work, men and women who work on the docks, the truckers, the railroad workers, essential workers who move commerce, which has a great impact, obviously, on our GDP, our economy. So I think the good news for us is it's not just about talk of how important this industry is. We've seen it particularly from this administration in terms of the investment, the funding in this industry in America's ports. You know, for the Port of Long Beach, we've had the Secretary of Transportation come to the San Pedro Bay complex already three times this year. And it's not just about visiting or talking, it's also funded. Port of Long Beach received the most significant funding by way of the PDIP grants, almost to the tune of $53 million, the largest of any port authority in the country. So we're very pleased that not only people are recognizing the importance, but like the Secretary said, it's not about no longer disinvestment.
Right.
It's about investment.
It's a shame it takes a crisis, though, for all that to happen.
Right.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about labor, and I want to draw your attention to a number that our colleague Scarlett Fu sent us earlier today when she knew that we were working with you later today. So last year, January 1st, 2021 through September 16th. This is according to Dow Jones. There were 150 strikes. The Cornell Strike Tracker has this. January 1st this year to the past Friday, there's been 273 strikes. How do you look at the power of the worker right now, especially in the context of strikes that could happen at the port at any time, given that you don't have a contract?
Well, number one, I don't believe that you're going to see a strike at the port or even a slowdown, at least not in the West Coast. So I'm very optimistic that the parties will come to a meeting of the minds.
But you thought it was going to happen by Labor Day, didn't you?
Well, I mean, we're still in September, so I'm a few weeks off. So
I'm not wearing white anymore. I put my spectator pumps away.
It feels like fall outside here in New York.
But I think that clearly there's no slowdown, much less a strike. And the volume numbers that I was just referencing earlier.
So no slowdown.
Yeah, the volume numbers I was just referencing earlier signifies that the productivity continues at a very high pace. In terms of the overall labor issue throughout the country, keep in mind that the average wages at least a couple months ago, you saw a 5.3% increase in wages. I think that number now is 6.3% across the board. So, you know, from my perspective, I mean, I think particularly with the American workforce, many of these industries for the past few years were rather stymied with regard to the wage increases. So it's no surprise that given that how good the economy has been, there's those sectors that want a piece of the pie.
Right. You don't get to be in the driver's seat very much when it comes to wages. Hey, just got about a minute or so left here. I want to go back, though, to the economy. And you said that there, you know, it sounds like we're not going to see empty shelves, that there's been a lot of kind of pre-advanced buying. Could we, though, start to see, or how quickly can things kind of start to slow down in terms of shipments? Does in your industry, how often do you maybe like, wow, all of a sudden things can slow down that you didn't see it coming?
We're starting to see that. Now, okay, let me qualify that, because we always thought that the surge that we experienced, particularly in the last year, was an unusual surge because of the reasons we've stated. So we're going to get back to some normalization. So when you compare our number for August, we moved up. Port Long Beach moved the most, had the most container volume of any port in the country.
Right.
However, we were still minus 0.1% compared to August 2021, which is a record year. So
right.
Are we in a minus? Technically, yes. Is it bad? No.
No, but okay. And no recession, you would say, at this point?
Not at this point, but again, we'll see what the Fed does in the coming week, and we'll go from there. I mean, the numbers right now are, we're trying to get to a point where we have a soft landing. And that's the kind of tricky point.
Fingers crossed.
What's the word for soft landing for a ship coming into port?
Well, any landing where you don't
hit the dock.
Hit the dock and you stay in one piece. Merrick Cordero, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Really
it's
gracious and so much time. Executive Director, Port of Long Beach, joining us here in our interactive.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broker Studio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, want to get to another story that is on the Bloomberg Terminal. It's part of the Bloomberg Tech Newsletter. Has to do with the merge, the crypto merge that we were all talking about last week.
We've got Hannah Miller right now. She's Bloomberg News Digital Currencies and VC reporter joining us on the phone from San Francisco. Hannah, how was your weekend?
It was a lot of fun. Yeah, it was nice to relax after doing some major merge coverage.
Okay, are you joking? Because of the the reason I ask is because we don't see Ether and Bitcoin stop trading on the weekends, and it was a down weekend for the cryptocurrency. So I don't know if you were being facetious there, and you had to work the whole time.
No, luckily I didn't have weekend duty.
Good.
Crypto markets never sleep.
Well, okay, what happened? You know, the merge was priced in. What's going on?
I feel like it's like Y2K 2.0. It's my 2.0
like
day, right?
Steroids,
remember,
right?
We thought everything was going to fall apart, could have fallen apart, and we thought the merge could have, like, you know, I feel like if something had gone wrong, it would have been a really big story.
It would have been. We would have seen huge disruption to trading, to the markets, really see startups flounder, but actually everything went really smoothly.
So what's the significance of it? You know, Hannah, I feel like we continue to learn more and more about this crypto world, and many would argue, certainly those within the world, that there's still a lot more to become. But what was the significance of this? Because this really tapped into, to some extent, the use of energy as well.
It's a really big deal because Ethereum migrated to proof of stake, which is a different way to validate and add transactions to the blockchain. Previously, Ethereum relied on proof of work, which is very energy intensive, uses large amounts of electricity. So it supposedly will reduce Ethereum's energy usage by 99%.
So when is the Bitcoin merge?
That is very unlikely to happen. You have really, strong proponents of Bitcoin who believe doing such a switch would undermine Bitcoin's core principles and that we would actually be a less secure, less decentralized way of running the blockchain.
So Hannah, raises the question, why does something like this work for Ethereum's blockchain, but not for Bitcoin's blockchain?
You know, Ethereum, it's pretty interesting. We do have the Ethereum Foundation, which is really active in educating people about this blockchain. We have Vitalik Buterin, who is just a huge force within the industry. He is the creator of Ethereum. So there's a little bit more coordinated effort, I guess, with Ethereum that we don't see with Bitcoin, which has, as we know, a pseudonymous founder in Satoshi Nakamoto.
You know, one other thing I wondered too, Hannah, is proof of work versus proof of stake. So now it's proof of stake. Proof of work to me, it's like, I don't know, maybe I'm being old fashioned. It's like, all right, show me your proof of work, right? In terms of the reliability, the security of it, is there a difference in terms of the security of your, you know, Ethereum ownership stake?
Yeah. So the argument here is that with proof of stake, it's a bit more centralized in terms of who's validating transactions on the blockchain. So if you have fewer parties involved, you know, something that affects one of those parties would have overall a bigger impact on the blockchain. So that's where that concern is. And people see Bitcoin as being much more decentralized and having a wider network of miners versus Ethereum's staking network.
Okay, so it kind of raises the question about why we saw such a precipitous decline over the weekend. And I'll just focus on Ether right now because we also saw it in Bitcoin. But was it about the merge or is it completely unrelated to the merge? I mean, I would say we knew the merge was coming. So isn't this just a sort of a, you know, stocks are going down, crypto's going down too?
Yeah, when I talk to people, they really bring up the macro conditions that we're seeing here that's
okay.
Dragging down on prices. Another thing to keep in mind is the merge did not immediately fix problems with Ethereum like congestion and high transaction fees. It's paving the way for later upgrades that will help with those things. But for example, the first NFT minted on the Ethereum network after the switch to proof of stake had a transaction fee of more than $60,000, which is massive.
That's, you know, I've got to, you know, assume that regulators are watching this closely. I'm going to be a little facetious here, but I'm assuming so the merge happens and now regulators are like, okay, everything's okay with Ether and it's okay with Ethereum and it's okay with crypto. Not even close, right? Regulators still have a lot of issues when it comes to cryptocurrencies overall.
Yes, we've already had Gary Gensler call out proof of stake networks and saying that they have qualities that could make the crypto on those networks classified as securities. So this is just another example of regulators homing in, you know, really just looking forward to tightening oversight of the digital asset industry.
So what are you looking for as somebody who reports on digital currencies and venture capital? Because you've got this sort of really interesting position. Venture capitalists are looking for what the next big thing is, and they're talking like the next generation, right? They're talking years away from big returns, finding that next Facebook or finding Bitcoin, you know, 10 years ago. Has their conversation shifted at all when it comes to how they're thinking about digital currencies or how they're thinking about Web3, given that it's been so brutal in terms of a sell-off?
Yeah, when I speak to VCs, many of them are still bullish on the space. They're in it for the long haul. They believe this is a great time to build, that amazing founders will come out of this crypto winter, and that this is only temporary. We've seen huge interest in NFTs and gaming, despite slumping NFT sales. So that's been really interesting. VCs are looking to really tap into mainstream ways to have crypto appeal to consumers. And they want, you know, just average people on board. They don't want to just stick with a crypto native audience.
Right, which is why you've heard some of the big fund houses, right? You know, thinking about or starting to offer
it. Did you say fund house or fun house?
No, not fun house.
I'm like, what?
Fund.
Okay. What's going on at these places?
Go to a fun house, play a few amusement park games. Hannah, thank you so much. Really glad that we got to check in with you. Hannah Miller, she's Bloomberg News digital currencies and VC reporter, joining us there on the phone. Just look at what?
I'm just going to say a little preview for what we've got coming. One of my decliners, Coinbase, today, because when you see big moves in crypto, you see big moves in the platforms that help trade them.
I'm looking at the crypto currency monitor on the Bloomberg terminal. Bitcoin down 1.2%. You've got XRP down 1.4%. Ethereum just down about 0.75%. But, you know, you go down Polkadot. What the heck is that? That's down about 5.5%.
And that's one that even made it into the cryptocurrency monitor.
Unbelievable.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, TikToks, everybody. TikTok, it is just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Having some fun with our guest in studio. Jake Jolly is with us, senior investment strategist at BNY Mellon Investment Management here in our Interactive Brokers studio. We're seeing some buying here in the last half hour or so.
I got to say, it even caught you off guard, Jake. You walked in here, you looked up at the TV, you said, oh my goodness, stocks are up today.
What's up with that?
I think it's going to be pretty choppy this week, right? We're all waiting for Wednesday. We're all very attentive to, you know, what's going to be coming, most notably, I think, in the summary of economic projections. That's what we're all, you know, Fed watchers, and I think everybody feels like a Fed watcher these days. But we're definitely looking there. I think we're going to see a higher median on the dot plot.
Yeah.
So I think we're all waiting for that. But until then, I think it's going to be a little bit choppy.
I think it's interesting that, yes, this has been a year of a lot of volatility, and here we have the VIX down a little bit today, and it's still at like 25. It's not like we've seen any big move up to 30 or 40 in particular. Do you think, based on what we get from the Fed, that it will be then potentially a major reset for some of your valuation models?
It's definitely possible. I think there are risks if the, you know, so-called economic pain that Chair Powell was mentioning at Jackson Hole, if we start to see that in a big way in the SEP, I think that's where we start to see the potential for a re-rating higher. I think I wouldn't say that's a, you know, highest likelihood. I think more likely we're going to see an SEP that hews very close to what the market is currently pricing in.
Okay, which is 75 basis points, obviously.
75 coming, and then, you know, getting pretty close to 4, a little north of 4 percent by the end of the year on the Fed funds rate. I think you could see a negative reaction in the market if we see something that is notably higher than sort of what is being currently priced in, which is, you know, just a little bit above 4%, and then peaking out by mid next year.
So the move up that we've seen in yields, particularly on the shorter end of the yield curve, but, you know, right now we've got the 10-year at 3.48, that 2-year note with 3.94, so just below 4%, and off its highs that we saw a little bit earlier in today's session. You know, we keep talking about, you know, where is the high in yields, like where does it settle down? Where's the low when it comes to the equity side of things? This move up in yields that we've seen, is it just volatility or is it seeking at a new high level?
Yeah, well, if you look historically, what we see is that rates continue to move higher while the Fed is hiking. And that's where so much of this uncertainty comes in, is that the the market has been continually this year having to increase those expectations of where the terminal rate's going to sit.
Right, because how many times have we talked about, okay, it looks like we're settling in.
Exactly. And right now, you know, I think last time I looked, we're sort of, you know, close to 4.5 at the peak for next year. But we'll see if the SEP comes out with something that is pretty close to that, or if they go above it. That's where I think we get a negative reaction. But on the flip side of that, I think if we see something much lower and we hear from Chair Powell some confidence that 4% is the right place to kind of do this hike and hold tactic, we may see, you know, a bit of a relief rally there.
Right, because we're kind of there, right?
Yeah, exactly.
How long is the hold? If it's a hike and hold strategy from Jay Powell.
That's, you know, we wish we would get some forward guidance on that, but we're probably not going to. So I think the Fed is in the position that they know they've done a lot of tightening. They've really tightened the screws on this economy. So they need to see how the economy holds up. And I think so far, the jury's still out. But when they look at the labor market, they're just not seeing the kind of slack, the softness that they would expect with so much tightening so far this year. So...
yeah. What gives there? Because we're starting to see softness in other areas. I mean, I think, Carol, today specifically, we've been talking a lot about the housing market and the data that we got earlier today. I mean, 9 month low, like 9 month declines for certain indicators for the housing market. So we're seeing it play out in some places. When do we start to see that play out in the labor market?
That's the problem. The labor market is oftentimes the last thing to move. And I think that one of the big debates out there is just that the fact that the labor market is so unprecedentedly tight right now, that, you know, trying to forecast when you're going to see that softening, it might be further out. And that's what I was kind of referring to there, is that the Fed, you know, is probably happy with the financial conditions tightening. But when they look at the labor market, they really haven't seen sort of the softness that they would have expected. Now, at the same time, they want it to be gradual, right? They don't want a very fast, rapid deterioration in labor market conditions.
Right.
So there's some positives there, you know. But our view is that if you're going to get sort of the so-called softish landing, you need the data to go in the Fed's favor and relatively quickly, because we don't think that rates can really go much higher than what is currently being priced in without things getting you know, slowing down quite significantly.
I mean, when you've got headlines like the 10-year, you know, we've talked about 3.5% first time since 2011, so in more than a decade. I mean, is that kind of a, you know, causes you to kind of pause for a moment? Is that, how do you see it in terms of what that potentially means?
Yeah, I mean, finding the right level is certainly difficult. And I know that all the brains at the Fed are thinking about this, looking at history, trying to figure out where that right rate is. I guess just to sort of point out one, you know, level is that if you look at where core PCE inflation is, you know, I think the last period was at about 4.6. So taking the Fed funds rate close to that level is when you start to see, at least by one measure, a positive real Fed funds rate. So I think that there is, you know, some rationale at that level for why they would want to hike and hold.
What are the problems created for investors in this environment where we continue to try and figure it out? But to be fair, you know, I keep saying it over and over again, we're coming out of a pandemic, we're coming out of unprecedented global stimulus. We don't exactly know how this plays out. And here we are talking recession, yet we've got a strong labor market. We would normally not do that.
Yeah. It's a very challenging environment. It has been for most of this year. I think, you know, to put an optimistic spin on it, the fact that we are getting the yields that we are now on the fixed income side certainly makes the
it's more competitive,
relative,
right?
Exactly. The relative attractiveness looks a lot better now.
Finally.
What's that?
It said finally.
Ah, finally. Exactly. It's a new regime. And although we are still in an inverted yield curve, so, you know, there isn't really that that compensation for moving out the curve. We are seeing much better opportunities relative to equities. And I think, you know, even if you believe that a softish landing is kind of potentially going to happen, you have to be very cautious in this type of market because we think that there is still downside risk in equities right now.
Swings can happen. But it does make you wonder, is it an anomaly when we get, you know, put this all in the textbooks, or is it the beginning of some kind of new trend going forward? Jake, great to catch up with you.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. Jake Jolly, he's Senior Investment Strategist at BNY Mellon Investment Management here in our Interactive Brokers studio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.